Real quick before we get started, I just got done editing the audio of this podcast, and I realized I forgot to mention I am giving away a copy of Tanner's book, The Appearance of Power. So stay tuned at the very end of the episode. I will go over how you can win that. Welcome to this week's episode of Lutheran Answers. I'm very excited. This week, I had the wonderful pleasure of interviewing my dear friend, Tanner Guzzi. Fun fact about me, I used to run a dating blog way back in like 2010. I met Tanner through blogging, and we've been very good friends ever since. I enjoy every conversation I get to have with this man. Over the last decade, I have watched him grow as a man and as a father, and just an impressive, impressive individual. I have watched him go from working at a bank to working as a fashion consultant with a bespoke men's clothing company to going out on his own and doing his own thing and being an entrepreneur. It's just been so great to watch Tanner. And over the years, I've watched him have many, many children. I remember when his first child was born, and now he has a lot more. Tanner is a wonderful man. I would like to qualify this interview because this is Lutheran Answers. I would like to point out up front that Tanner is a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. He is a Mormon. So he is obviously going to have severe theological disagreements with me and I with him. However, the purpose of this interview was to talk about fatherhood and instilling your values into your children. And that is something that we can all agree is good and necessary and worth talking about. And Tanner is an expert on exactly this. So I hope you really enjoy this episode of Lutheran Answers, where we talk about aspirational fatherhood with Tanner Guzzi. So much for agreeing to do this with me, man.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Remy. I'm excited to talk to you today, dude.
Awesome, man. So we met in 2010.
Has it been that long? It's been 11 years.
I think it's been that long, dude. We were both blogging at the time. I was blogging about picking up chicks, and you were blogging about style.
Yep.
And I think our lives have evolved in pretty dramatic directions. Overall. So what are you doing now with Masculine Style? What are your goals?
So Masculine Style is still going strong. It's now my full-time gig. I've been totally self-employed for coming up on 5 years now.
That's amazing.
It's we're very blessed that we get to do this, that I get to do this because I get to work from home. I make enough that my wife gets to stay home full-time. We homeschool the kids. We have five. And so it really does facilitate a family first focus, as opposed to that kind of having to be sacrificed on the altar of, a particular business or even just business growth or anything like that. For me, we've been really, really blessed there. And so, yeah, I teach men how to dress like they've got some semblance of self-respect and teach them. Nice. I call it aesthetic literacy, how you can communicate with your clothing as effectively as you communicate with your written and your spoken language. It's been a great gig. I absolutely love getting to do it. And it's fun to see how more and more men are resonating, especially with this culture war that we're in. A lot of men are resonating with the idea that, the enemies of goodness, they celebrate ugliness. And they've kind of tricked a lot of us into thinking that beauty doesn't matter, that any desire for beauty, is all vanity. And that's not the case at all. God loves beauty. God absolutely loves that. He created a beautiful world for us. And there certainly is a line that you can cross when you get into vanity, but there's a lot of inherent value in beauty. And so helping people not only recognize that, but then start to manifest that in their own lives is really a blessing to get to do.
Yeah. We, in Lutheran theology, we, and you're a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
Correct.
Okay. So in Lutheran theology, we have a divide, where we talk about, you don't want to fall into the ditch on either side of the road.
Yeah. The straight and narrow path.
You want to be middle of the road. Mm-hmm. And there's so many people that they want to avoid vanity, which is like a left-hand ditch over here somewhere, that they go all the way to the right and they end up in the ditch on the other side of the road, don't even realize it and think they're
absolutely
doing okay.
Absolutely. And we do that with so many of our virtues, that we take them to an extreme that they become vices, mm-hmm. or we recognize vices and we get so terrified that we overcorrect and we absolutely end up on the other side of the ditch for sure.
Yeah. So having children and having a lot of children, if I understand LDS theology correctly, is like literally a part of your religion. Like you want to have kids. You find it to be a duty to have children.
Yeah.
And with that comes a lot of responsibility.
Yeah, absolutely.
Go ahead.
Well, the command, the first commandment that God gave to Adam and Eve to multiply and replenish the earth hasn't been rescinded. We're still under that same commandment. We're still under that same moral obligation. And so it is, it's a responsibility and a duty. And we believe that, that if we don't live up to what that is, that we'll be held accountable for that, that those spirit sons and daughters that would have had the opportunity to be born into this environment at this time, there's accountability for our not living up to that. Yep.
Okay. So with that, obviously it's not enough to just have kids,
right?
You can't just have them and go. You have to raise them and be there. And you are very outspoken on Twitter about being not just a good man and a good husband, but being a good father. And I just really wanted to explore that with you because it comes through how much you love your children and it comes through how well you're raising them. I guess basically at the end of the day, I just kind of want to know what is your key advice for impressing your values into your children?
This is something that has been top of mind for me for a long time. I hate the way that fatherhood is treated in the world. I hate it.
Yeah, it's a joke.
It is. It's a joke. And it's not only a joke from the perspective of the way that other people perceive fatherhood, but it's a joke in the way that fathers perceive themselves. We spiritually castrate ourselves by treating our roles as I'm something that's a mix between like a babysitter and the oldest child and kind of the cool uncle, as opposed to understanding that we're responsible to lead our families and to set the tone. And I hate it. I hate seeing it. I hate that that my kids' spouses are likely being raised in environments that are like that. And that's something that's going to have to be combated. And so, I mean, honestly, Remy, you look at almost any one of our problems in civilization and it can be tied back into a lack of good fathers. We try to blame things on race or on economic level, or we try to blame it on, access to resources. It almost always just comes down to there's not a good involved father in the home. Sometimes it's because the dad's a deadbeat. Sometimes it's because the mom is a complete harpy and a shrew and won't let her kids have access to their dad. And there's multiple reasons for it, but so many problems can be laid at the feet of the destruction of the family.
Yeah. The destruction of the family almost seems, it's intentional. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely, it's intentional. You can see it in the way you said that dads view their role as something between the cool uncle, the babysitter, and the eldest child. Mm-hmm. And that is, I've never, it's so like that, right? It's so portrayed like that. I saw a guy talking about marketing. And okay. He was talking about how in commercials, women are portrayed as confident and smart and intelligent, and men are portrayed as not that way, unless we're talking about certain products. If we're talking about financial products, banking products, mm-hmm. insurance, in those realms, men usually make more purchases and they're displayed as more confident. But in the rest of greater society, we're not actually catering to men, so it doesn't matter.
No, we're not buying the consumer products. Most of that discretionary income is spent by women. Yeah.
Yeah. And so then the I don't know if it's conscious, unconscious, a cohesive effort, but the net result ends up being in all popular media, in commercials, everywhere, we're doofuses, right? Mm-hmm. It's wild. I went to a job interview, and I think you'll get this, the difference between like guys and men.
Yes.
And so I went to a job interview. Or not interview, it was an orientation. And the lady running the orientation said that one time she had to work with all guys and she was the only woman and it was the worst experience of her life. And I said, hey, that's actually really sexist for you to say mm-hmm. that working in a group of men's the worst experience. Like if I had gotten up there and said working with all women was the worst experience of my yeah. life, I'd have been fired in my orientation. And so I pointed out that, hey, that came across as kind of sexist. And what was it about working with all men that was so terrible? And her response was, you know, and like every dude in the room was like, yeah, guys, you know how we are. And they all started like fake burping.
Oh, gosh.
And talking about like sports, like, oh, yeah, just football's all I care about. And it's like, what are you guys? No one like you don't they don't take themselves seriously.
Right. Right. Yeah. Especially because seriousness is risky. It requires the willingness to embarrass yourself. It requires the willingness to be rejected. And so much of what we get in modern masculinity, one of my friends termed it as boomer masculinity. It's like beer and bacon and boobs. And like, that's it. That's the only kind of stuff that we get to kind of appreciate about being men. And even then it's done very tongue in cheek. It's the whole man cave aesthetic and all that kind of stuff too. And it really is, it's this ironic version of masculinity where if I treat it like a joke and kind of like, you know how we are like this, we're just a bunch of gross weirdos. Then when we get rejected for being men, then we're in on the joke too. And so it doesn't hurt that much.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. And so it really is, it's a fear-based approach. And the opposite, the sincerity that's required to be able to be a patriarch, to be able to be involved as a father, to be able to be even things that are outside of that, to be an entrepreneur, to be good at your job, to like masculinity requires seriousness. And too many of us are too quick to dismiss it because we don't want to. It's too risky to be serious. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And we don't want to be responsible.
Right.
It's a lot easier to clock in and clock out and watch football and than it is to actively raise my children, actively be there for my spouse to, even if you are working a job, to like act like it's your company and like take some ownership in what you do and put some effort into your job.
Yep.
You know, it's how do we fight that? How do we fight that as men, as fathers? How do we fight that?
I think one of the biggest things, I actually just spoke at a conference in Florida this week, and I was in a specific kind of arena that was built for fathers. It was built for them. And this is what I presented on, but it's the idea of parent orientation or like kind of ancestral or even God orientation versus peer orientation, because we're in a very unique time in our history where most of culture, most of what's cool and what isn't, most of what's acceptable and what isn't, most of, especially when you look at music or movie or movies or art or architecture or anything else, it goes in these like 10 to 15 year waves, these kind of like small generational waves. And it's because the chain that used to exist from us going back to our ancestors or also from us going forward into our posterity has largely been broken. It's been broken by the Industrial Revolution. It's been broken by the Sexual Revolution. It's been broken by feminism. It's been broken by pushes for homosexuality and androgyny and the transgender stuff. It's been broken in a lot of ways to where the only way that you can orient yourself is by your peers. And young kids in daycare, let alone in elementary school or in high school or anything else, are dealing with this, where everything about their moral compass or their social compass or everything else is determined by what their friends pick, as opposed to being oriented towards God or towards tradition or towards any of these other things that have much more longevity to them. And it's akin to, you know, let's say you have like a whole nest of ducklings that hatch and they all imprint on each other as opposed to on the mother. And then they're trying to figure out how to be ducks by learning from each other as opposed to learning from the mother. They're all going to end up dead. And so spiritually, that's what's happened to us, is we've all ended up spiritually dead because we're imprinting on each other as opposed to imprinting on the people and the organizations and ultimately the God that can actually help us get to where we need to be.
I read a fascinating article yesterday about some 28 to 30% of young people now outside of the, no, inside of the millennial generation, born between 1988 and 2002, I think, identify as somewhere on the LGBT spectrum.
Yeah.
And the researchers were quick to note that most of these people aren't any shade of gay at all, and that it's simply easier to identify and then be a part of an organization or a group that will accept you than be an outsider not in that group.
Yeah. And you can just say, oh, I don't absolutely cringe whenever I see a dude with like capped shoulders. I can aesthetically appreciate that because he looks jacked and he looks awesome. So yeah, maybe I'm a little bit gay. Okay. So I'm going to identify this way. So then I'll all of a sudden I'm at the outcast for being 100% straight. It's a total status signal.
Yeah.
Yep.
How do you teach your son? You have a son.
I do. I have four daughters and one son.
Yeah. Nice. Fighting the fight.
Right. Yep. We're right in the thick of it. Yeah.
How do you teach him to avoid these things?
So the first thing that you have to do is you have to break the chain yourself. You have to stop being the dopey dad, because one of the reasons why we get so peer oriented is because we see parents that we don't want to become that way. How many men, and Remy, tell me if you were this way. I know I was this way. I didn't want to grow up and get married and have kids, because doing all that meant the death of my individuality. It meant the death of my friendships. It meant the death of my own personal ambition. It just meant becoming a lame, suburban, middle-class, fat guy that my wife doesn't love me and certainly doesn't sleep with me, and my kids don't respect me. And I just become this consumer, which is really how I saw so many of the men in my life.
Yeah.
Why would I want to become that? When being a teenager as a boy is freaking rad. You get to do cool stuff and you take risks and you have all your friends and you're dating all these girls and like it's awesome. So yeah. Why would I give that up for the boring, slow death of fatherhood? And that's the way it's portrayed. And so one of the first things that I do with my kids is I don't stop improving. My kids see me. We have a home gym in the garage. My kids see me out there. My kids see that my friends come over and lift with me multiple times a week. They see me learning how to play the cello, you know, and start new habits this way. They see me go out and play with them on the trampoline, and I can do backflips with them if we're playing out on the trampoline. Or, you know, there are ways to make it so that they see adulthood and especially parenthood for what it really is. Because this is the reality, is my life is infinitely better after embracing and accepting the responsibility of being a father. I took, I was a very kind of like go along to get along. I didn't have a ton of ambition. And then when I got married and when we found out that my wife was pregnant with our first and we knew we wanted her to stay home, it lit a fire under me that I could no longer justify being mediocre. I had to pursue excellence. And so it's not even this like faking it thing or trying to be cool on a level that my kids are cool, but it's continuing to pursue things that make my life worth living and modeling that for them and then bringing them into that world. So I think that's the very first step, is you have to become somebody that they actually want to emulate, whether that's my son wanting to become like me or my daughter's wanting to marry somebody who's like me.
So aspirational fatherhood really is the perfect way to look at it. You mm-hmm. you give them something to aspire to, someone who they want to be like.
Yep. Yeah. Where they look at it and go, okay, I want into that world. I want to be like dad.
Yeah. How do you break the chain yourself? Like what are steps you take to avoid being peer driven and instead being more ancestral or God focused or what have you?
So the first thing and the biggest thing for me is absolutely being actively involved in my church. Mm-hmm. Being involved to the point where it's not just something that you do on Sundays. It's not this right. just kind of like passive compartmentalized thing, but it bleeds into everything. Every podcast I go on, questions come up, and the only real honest way to be able to answer those questions is by alluding to or outright just talking about my religious beliefs and the theology and the doctrines and everything that are related to that. And it used to be that I would kind of dance around that, or, you know, feel like, well, you know, this is a secular podcast, or this is this. And so I just stopped doing it that way. I started tweeting more openly or posting more openly about my faith on Instagram. When my friends in the neighborhood come over and we lift, we have a religious conversation every single time we're together. And it may be related to something as trivial as, you know, how the local college's football team is doing, or, you know, how does progressive overload relate to eternal progression? Like these little, but when you integrate it, when your beliefs become integrated and they become part of your life, then you no longer feel like it has to be compartmentalized, and it makes it a lot easier to see God in everything. It makes it a lot easier to really revere and emulate the prophets and church leaders and those who have made these sacrifices. And then it also makes it easier to work through the anger and eventually forgive your parents for the ways that they failed, or to see how what their parents did affected them and impacted them. And so it's made me love my parents more. It makes me love my grandparents more. It makes me want to know and understand my great grandparents more. It really does feel like, you know, in Malachi, where it talks about how we're waiting for Elijah to come to turn the hearts of the fathers to the children and the hearts of the children to the fathers, lest the whole earth be smitten with a curse. It really feels like that, where if we don't get turned to seeing our ancestors and seeing our posterity, then we're going to continue to experience this curse that it feels like we're already in the middle of.
Do you think our current culture, I know you've referred to it as a culture war, and I just want to go on the record for my listeners out there and say, no, I agree. We're like dead in the middle of like an all-out culture war. Do you think it's possible to turn the tide? Something we've been talking a lot about in Lutheran circles is this lie that history progresses to the left socially. Mm-hmm. And that it's inevitable and it's going that way and there's nothing you can do to stop. But that's a lie.
Yeah, this is one of those things that always gets really tricky, right? Because I think every Christian, especially when you're in the middle of the cycle of the soft men create hard times and the hard times that create strong men, we're kind of like right in the middle of that. And everybody feels like, I assume everybody feels like, no, this is it. This is the one where we're getting ready for the second coming, where we're getting ready for everything to totally like fall apart. And this is the big one. I'm sure that especially at the point that it had gotten into physical war, like during World War I and World War II, that they felt like that. And they saw so much of the cultural and social degeneracy. And now we can like we can look back and then go, oh, that's cute that you guys thought the times were wicked back then, you know? I mean, the murder and the war and everything was absolutely atrocious, and we're nowhere near that. But all the other stuff, it's like, that's adorable that you guys thought that things were really wicked, because you don't know what it's like now. And who knows? Maybe Christ's return is imminent and he's going to be back here in 2 years or in 2 months, or maybe it's still another 200 years from now. And so it either feels like this is actually the end, and our responsibility is not to try to turn the tide, but it's to try and carve out as many souls as we can to bring them into goodness and to be able to have them be ready for that. Or this is just another wave in the cycle, and it's going to be able to turn, and we're going to go back into another kind of the hard men that create good times, and people will turn around and culture will change again. The thing that's encouraging me about it is that my attitudes and my actions don't change either way. I don't have to look at it or approach it any differently, because my responsibility is to fight the culture war on as many fronts as I can. And whether that's actually changing the culture or just helping as many people as possible before the second coming, doesn't matter. The tactics are the same.
Right. And a lot of people too, they forget how necessarily insular they can be in that fight. Like sometimes, like you don't have to go out and protest this or stop buying Coca-Cola because the CEO said something at a, what, you don't just like raise good kids.
Yeah.
Right. Like so much of it is just being there for your family and your friends. Right. And just raise good kids.
Be a good neighbor. Help them raise their kids. And, you know, because you, like, you should know who your kids' friends are and their parents, or their parents should know who your kids are. And it should be communal in that aspect. Know the people you go to church with. Say things. And, you know, I think you're right. I don't think you need to necessarily like protest this and boycott that. But at the same time, I think a lot of times things continue to get worse because too many of us do get too insular, where we don't say the risky things on social media, or we don't speak up for our beliefs. And then that's why it gets to the point that they feel like they can punish us for doing that, for the few of us that do stick our necks out. And so find ways to be more socially courageous and stand up for what you believe in, as opposed to just going along to get along too.
Do you think politics or like the news, how important is that to you?
I try to parse it out in that it is important from a rational perspective, so that I'm not ignorant to what's going on, especially because it's my responsibility to know that. But it shouldn't be important from an emotional or from a spiritual perspective. Like the things that really get me going, either a positive or a negative, should have nothing to do with national or global politics. Those should be things that are happening more locally.
Right.
My kids have no idea who the president is. And it's not because they're dumb kids. Yeah. They're not. But like, what's the point at right now? At some point, they'll be old enough that we need to start introducing them to that. But my kids don't know who he is. We were able for a very long time to make it, especially because we were already homeschooling and doing everything at home anyway. It took a long time for my kids to even realize that COVID was a thing, you know, where, like it was, you know, for us, we were very minimally impacted for a long time. And so there was, I think it, we spend, you remember in Screwtape Letters, where he talks about if you can get the subject to focus on changing the world outside of him and ignore his mother or ignore the people that are around him. And I think it goes back to what you're saying, where men want to, they want to avoid being responsible, because if I'm going to change the world with my social media, or I'm going to, you know, try and like, I'm going to solve global warming, or I'm going to solve racism or something else, then really what you've built into the back of your head is this plausible deniability, because who am I? I'm just one little guy and I can't do that. So if I fail, it doesn't matter, but if I'm going to fix my family, or if I'm going to help be a positive impact on my neighborhood, you can do that. And if you fail at that, you don't get the plausible deniability of I bit off more than I can chew, or I'm just one small piece in this multifaceted machine. And so I think that Lewis was spot on when he said that one of the tricks that the adversary uses is trying to get us to focus on what we can do globally instead of what we can do locally or familially. Yeah.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. Screwtape Letters is such a good read.
So good.
Such a good
read. My only gripe with it, and I even hate that it's a gripe with it, is that in there, Lewis talks about the one vice that they couldn't turn into a virtue was cowardice.
Oh, no. And
they've now been able to do that.
Nailed it.
They've now been able to turn cowardice into a virtue, too.
Absolutely.
And that just makes me – it's heartbreaking.
Yeah, that's the wildest
thing. To think that they've been able to do that.
Yep. That's the wildest thing. I saw like some screen cap of some article on Twitter yesterday, and it was like, how can I repair my relationship with my daughter after she broke my trust? And the whole thing
I saw this
was
one.
All about the COVID. And then how she came home and her daughter was sitting on the couch without a mask 2 feet away from her friend.
And they were sharing the same popcorn bowl.
Right. And I was like, why do you hate your kids? That's my question.
Mm-hmm. Because they've made cowardice into a virtue.
That's wild.
Yeah.
No, that's wild. They really have. They really have at this point. It's amazing. Yep. What's really amazing from a Christian standpoint is how many people are just afraid to die.
Mm-hmm.
Just and absolutely.
Not even die. We're not dying yet.
Right. Yeah.
How many people are afraid to just let your career die or let your social standing die or let the number of Facebook friends you have die, let alone actually die?
Yeah. Yeah. It's going to be wild. It's going to be wild when they get to the point that like they actually start hanging us, you know, to see. I saw this graph once of it had three guys. It had atheist, and then it had real Christian, and then it had guy who says he's a Christian.
Okay.
And then guy who says he's a Christian goes over, and now it's Christian, guy who says he's an atheist, atheist. And and then the headline underneath the second picture was like people leaving the church, or like Christians are leaving the faith. Well, no, not really. You know, not really, just sort of the nominal people that don't.
They're social chameleons.
Yeah.
It's these middle of the road social chameleons that, you know, if all of a sudden it'd be so funny to hear it too. But if all of a sudden the powers that be just started saying, it really is so 1984, we've always been at war with Eurasia. We've always been atheists. We've always worshipped Odin. You know, all of a sudden the number of pagans that we would have amongst our ranks in a week would be nuts.
The number of pagans we have amongst our ranks already is pretty nuts.
Right. I mean, you know, but you pick whatever religion you want and you get these social chameleons that their most core doctrinal belief is whatever is going to create the least amount of friction for me socially. Yep.
That's wild. That's wild. Do you worry about your children growing up in this world? I imagine not too much.
No, I don't. I try to. Okay, there's like the long-term undertone of not fearing about it, and then there are little spikes of it when you see things happen or anything else. But I really try to the whole doubt not, fear not, or fear and faith are mutually exclusive. In if you have fear in your heart, there's not room for faith. And I'm trying to work on that. I'm trying to have more faith and to recognize that that's even what needs to be modeled for my kids too. Because one of the ways that you can make fatherhood or adulthood aspirational is when they see everybody else freaking out about everything. They don't see me being blissfully naive, but they see me being faithful about the fact that there are still good things that are happening, even in the midst of the chaos that we're in right now.
How big of a role does, I think you've probably already answered this to a degree, but how big of a role does your faith specifically play in fatherhood for you?
It's everything. It is the core and the root of everything. Mm. Everything ties back to it with, there are no degrees of separation. Everything I try to do as a father plugs directly back into my faith and those theological beliefs, 100%.
Yeah. Do you think it's circular in that your kids encourage you to strengthen your faith? Your faith encourages you to be a better father to your children, which encourages you to. It's a self feeding.
It's a virtuous circle. Yeah. Absolutely. Yep. 100%. And that's what's so frustrating is when we disrupt that with something, we disrupt it with fear, we disrupt it with consumerism, we disrupt it with porn or with whatever else, then that cycle stops. Whereas it's supposed to be continually going up and around and up and around. They're supposed to constantly be feeding each other.
Yeah. How is it being a husband in times like this?
It's great. I mean, I love it. I'm so grateful to be married to my wife, especially because she sees it for what it is. There are a lot of women out there that they would be hard to be married to. There are a lot of women out there that would be hard to be married to. And my wife is not one of them. She is fully ride or die with me. She's just That's as committed amazing. To the gospel yeah. as I am. She's as committed to me as she is to the gospel. The sacrifices that she makes in order to make sure that our kids are taken care of, are Herculean, and the things that she's not only willing to give up, but just anxious to give up so that our kids can be raised the way that they should be, so that I can be treated the way that I should be. It's huge. Yeah. And so I couldn't do this on my own. I certainly couldn't do this being married to an antagonistic woman. You get that same kind of virtuous cycle, or the complementary effect too. I think, sadly, and my friend Ken Curry talked about this last week too, in his presentation at this conference. But sadly, I think most of us look at power dynamics within a relationship as kind of a zero sum game, where if I have power and authority, it comes at the expense of her having power and authority. And I think that's what happens when we get more kind of androgynized as a people.
Yeah.
Whereas you have a very complementary masculine power and a feminine power. And as I magnify my masculine power, it creates the space and the opportunity and even some of the momentum for my wife to be able to maximize or magnify her feminine power. And then that does the same thing for me until we become even more powerful. Because we're both working on our own power individually or our power collectively. And so it's not zero sum at all. It's incredibly cooperative and complementary.
Yeah. I definitely find, there's a lot of like weird evil ideas around marriage and family today. And there's completely equal. We're the exact same. There's no difference between a husband and a wife. And that's wrong on one end. But then on the other end, you have this, like, I'm the husband and I must control everything. And it's the, when you love your wife, there's not that either of those things. You're right. She has a role. I have a role. And when we each do those things, it works together to build the whole family as a unit up. There's a purpose.
Exactly. And it's amazing what you can do when you trust each other to fulfill those roles, and you trust each other enough that when one of you fails in that role, you still allow them to fail and then to be able to build more and to do more from it too. I've failed plenty of times in my role as a provider, or just in other roles as a husband, or even in roles as a father. And my wife could have nagged or could have scolded or could have done what so many wives do, but she trusted me that I would go through that and I would learn from it and benefit from it. And we're all better because of those failures. And it's the same thing with things that she's stumbled on or fumbled on as a wife or as a mother too. And so a big part of that trust is allowing that, not even delegation, maybe delegation, but that separation enough that you won't even step in if they're going to fail. I mean, obviously, if it's catastrophic, you know, if your wife's beating your kids or something, then step in. But so many of these failures that we fear are actually really good growth opportunities, and they need to be experienced.
Yeah. Yeah. I was hesitant to get married for a long time. Marriage is portrayed as a joke.
Totally.
That's one of those slow deaths. Like you were talking about fatherhood, and marriage is absolutely portrayed that way. And I don't get it. I don't get it, because you're right. Being married is awesome.
Yeah, but don't you get it? I mean, that's how you kill the family. You make marriage look like it's ridiculous. Yeah. You take this beautiful thing and you make it look ugly and constrictive and claustrophobic. Like, I totally get it. I mean, it sucks that we've fallen for it.
Yeah.
But it makes sense that this is why this has happened. The adversary is working overtime to make families look like it is the absolute death of any sort of happiness.
And it's just crazy, because it's at the core, I think, of a lot of temporal happiness. You can't.
Totally.
There's no doing this on your own. I couldn't imagine doing this on my own.
No way.
It's too much. The world is too much. Life is overwhelming without having someone there. I don't see how people do this without family, and I don't see how they do it without faith at all. Like, you've got to plug into something bigger than yourself. I have a friend of mine. He's got his second child now, and he lives at home with his parents. And him and his wife both live in his parents' house, and they have two kids. And at first I was like, well, that's terrible. You should move out and get your own place and be a man. But the more I watch, the more I think, like, actually, I don't know. I think he's probably onto something, and he'll get his own house one day. But right now, he has a great job. He makes a ton of money, and he doesn't pay any rent. His wife stays at home and raises their two children. And if she ever has questions, because she's never been a mom before. Mm-hmm. So if she ever has questions, grandma is right there. Right there. Grandma's done this half a dozen times.
Right.
You know, and there's it's a part of her culture. I don't want to dox my friend, but it's a part of her culture where it's multi-generational living in a household mm-hmm. like that. And that's a very ancient kind of a practice. And I wonder if we haven't lost something by you said the Industrial Revolution is one of these things that has sort of cropped up and is working kind of against us. And it's true because now people move for work. They move away. They voluntarily separate and segment and segregate themselves away from a support structure, away from their families, their friends, their church for opportunity, in quotes.
Right. And we lionize it. We call it being independent.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The American dream.
Right.
Yeah.
Is to somehow completely disconnect yourself from everybody you know and love so that you can become a more efficient economic unit.
That's wild.
That's the wild. American dream right there.
Yeah.
It's insane.
Yeah. And good news. Good news. Now your wife can too. Great.
Right. Yeah. So you can both do that. And yeah, then
don't worry. No, we'll raise your kids. It'll be fine.
It's weird. I feel like we've definitely been psyoped into it. And like we talked about at the beginning, there's certainly ways that you can fall off in either direction where, and who knows, maybe it's my own cultural conditioning where I would love to be able to be in a neighborhood where, my parents are close enough that my kids could walk down to their place mm-hmm. or ride their bikes over to their place, that my siblings and their families are that close that you would pick where you lived based on the people that you love. At the same time, living under my parents' roof again would absolutely terrify me.
Yeah.
Or same thing with the in-laws. And you wonder, is that just a cultural conditioning thing? Mm-hmm. If we were to go back to where our ancestors are from 1,000 years ago, if they would say, well, no, what do you mean you're going to move out? Like, yeah, we're going to build you your own little cottage that's kind of on the property with the rest of us, but that's it.
Right.
And yeah, I think we do. We can throw the baby out with the bathwater going either direction. And I mean, it's the same thing with, you know, you see the meme about Gen X and they were left as latchkey kids and, you know, their parents were completely disconnected from them. And so it's no wonder that you have all the boomers and the silent generation parents that are just being dumped off in nursing homes, because right. if you didn't raise me and there was none of that parent orientation. I mean, Gen X is a perfect example of this peer orientation, mm-hmm. then it doesn't go that way. And no, I think that kids absolutely should have exposure to grandparents, like constant exposure to grandparents, yeah. to aunts and uncles, to that family culture. So it's not just my weird mom and dad that do things differently, but it's reinforced by everybody else too.
Yeah. Yeah. It would be great if the block you lived on, like everyone in a mile radius here is cousins, uncles.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Which I think could be one of the biggest blessings of COVID and the internet industry in general is as you get more and more people that can work remotely. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't be surprised, especially where we're already starting to see the beginnings of migrations. You're seeing people go from blue states to red states and all of that. I would actually be surprised if we didn't see this happen, that sometime within the next 5 to 10 years, you would have massive migrations of people finding out that, you know, actually the people that I want to be, that I want to live by, are the people that are ideologically aligned with me. And I want my kids to marry people like their kids, that you just decide we're all going to go buy land and live in this neighborhood together. We're all going to, you know, there's this new development going up and we're all going to go buy lots right next to each other. And you get this more intentional community building as mm-hmm. opposed to I'm going to move somewhere because I have to work. And then I'm just going to try and be friends with the people I coincidentally live next to.
Right. I was saying this to my wife and I don't think she understood completely what I was trying to say, but modern apartments are like a demonic bastardization of like ancient communal living.
Uh-huh.
'Cause you look at like old communal living, there was a little row of houses and each family had their own little house, or maybe you had a couple families in a house. And maybe we were related, maybe not, maybe distantly. But there was five or six families, and one guy was a farmer, one guy was a tanner, one guy was this, one guy was that. And there was a lot of property that we kept the farm on, and the people did, the guys did their thing. The women raised the children who could run outside and play in this sort of communal grass area. And now I live in an apartment building with 126 other people that I do not know. There is absolutely no outdoor space that I can go to and meet people and be just outside. The outside is a parking lot.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
it's ugly. It's ugly, and it doesn't foster community at all. And even if it were more aesthetically beautiful, those people in that apartment, they're going to be gone in 9 months,
right?
Or the other people down the hall are going to be gone in 9 months. There's no sense of permanence. Yeah. So why invest in getting to know these people? And no, you're right. Apartment living is its own version of hell.
And even though we're all jam packed in here like sardines, there's no community.
No.
Which is fascinating.
Yeah. And proximity without community is miserable.
Yeah. Yeah. I've actually made a point of getting to know all of my neighbors. I know all the people on my floor. I chat with them. I help them out. You know, if I see like you have a package and I see that your car is not there, I'm going to go ahead and leave a note on your door and grab your package so that some jerk doesn't steal it. You know what I mean? Like,
yes,
I make a point of trying to like be there. So I don't know. It's just, it's wild to me. Modernity is wild.
It really is. And especially because you're the outlier for doing that, to the point where a lot of people will feel like, why is this guy doing it? Why is he in my business?
Right.
And you're just, no, I'm just trying to be a good neighbor.
Yeah. That's
all it is. I'm just trying to be a good neighbor.
At the day job, I talk to people all day long where they'll call in and say, hey, I have this problem with my neighbor. They're doing X, Y, Z. And I'll say, well, have you tried going to talk to them about it? and the reactions, they're priceless every time. It's always like, I don't know those people. You've lived next to them for 6 years. How do you not know them? Most people are nice. Just, hey, I'm your neighbor.
Yep. And they're probably pretty lonely too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's wild. It's wild. So these are problems we can solve, but they're problems that have to be solved on an individual level. Like you have to commit to being a good father, which means committing to being a good person first.
Yep.
You have to commit to getting to know your neighbors, but to do that, you got to like put on pants and knock on their door.
Right. Yeah, for me, that's one of the biggest blessings of having the home gym. That was one of the reasons why we did it. And we have it a lot easier where our church congregation is basically just our neighborhood, you know? Mm. And so we see these people in church every week, and we do activities together. So it already kind of like facilitates that and makes that a little bit easier. But I've made it a point when we moved into this neighborhood 2.5 years ago that I was going to have the home gym. And I found five or six guys that I just, you interested in lifting? You should come over. We do it, you know, 3 days a week at my place at 7:30 in the morning. And they come and we get to do stuff together. Or, you know, it's the kids that my kids are friends with. We're friends with their parents, where on the first Sunday of every month, we do a big barbecue and we just alternate whose backyard it's in. Or, you know, all the parents, we just got done playing, we did a round of indoor soccer where we were all on a team together, and it was really fun because we all go cheer on our kids when they play their games. And this was kind of the inverse, where our kids would all come and sit in the stands and cheer us on as parents while we were playing. And it's just a matter of putting yourself out there and facing the risk of being rejected, because I still have way more people who decline me on my offer to come lift in my garage.
Right.
But the ones that not only come, but come consistently, are men that I love and respect, and I'm really grateful for them. And then I get to learn to love and respect their wives and their kids. And it really does become a community. And it just starts by you being the first one to say, let's go to a movie night, or come work out in my garage, or, you know, the amount of zucchinis that we get because everybody grows those in their garden and they get passed around and all, like, it's wonderful. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. At our church, we often talk about how can we grow? What can we do for growth and all this? And, you know, we need this kind of outreach program. We need that kind of outreach program. Tanner, my church is literally in a neighborhood. I have to drive into a neighborhood to get to my church. and we have a community garden at our church. Like, why? Okay, so we can talk about fancy outreach programs and this and that, but why don't we get a basket and fill it with fruit and veg from this community garden, mm-hmm. and then go into this neighborhood that we are in the middle of and just knock on doors. Hey, do you?
It's a novel idea, Remy.
You want some peppers? We grow them at the church over here.
Yep.
You know, I don't want to change my entire city of Fayetteville. I don't want to do that. I just want to get that neighborhood that we're in coming to my church. Like, that's what I want.
It's where it starts.
That's what I want. And I don't know. That's wild. Yeah. So how can, as men, how can we take ourselves more seriously?
The first thing that I would recommend, you're going to think I'm going to say style because that's what I do for a living, but it's not. Go to the gym.
Okay.
Go to the gym, start lifting weights, or get involved in a combat sport, or get involved in some sort of an endurance sport or something. But the mind, body, and spirit they're inseparably connected. And one of the biggest inroads that the adversary has been able to make is through our bodies. It's through the crap that we eat. It's through the fact that we're so complacent and lazy. It's the fact that we're so comfort focused and oriented. And there are so many things that you learn about yourself by starting to take care of yourself physically, but then it also does physiologically change the chemicals in your brain. And then I would say it also spiritually changes that connection as well. It opens up those connections too. The best thing I've ever done on my own journey of self-development was stop being afraid of the gym and start going. And for me, it was lifting weights. And then that led to boxing, and that led to Spartan races and half Ironmans and all of these other things that, because especially as men, the bar doesn't lie, or the clock doesn't lie. And then when you learn to measure yourself against something that's objective and you learn how to work to build that up, like you start to develop a real sense of confidence, both from the successes and the failures that come with that. And so that's the first thing that I would say is get in the gym, whatever that looks like, get in the gym.
Have you ever heard of Father Raphael Capo?
No, I haven't.
Oh, you should check him out. He's a Roman Catholic priest. And he's got to be like 50. But dude is jacked, jacked. And his big thing is you should always be fit for the kingdom and strong in body, mind, and spirit. That's just kind of what.
Oh, man. Speaking my language. Yeah. Yep. Yep.
So that's awesome, man. Tanner, thank you so much for doing this with me, dude.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on, man.
Anything I can plug for you?
You know what?
You have a great book, The Appearance of Power. I'll link that.
Awesome. Also, if you guys want to hear more about this kind of stuff, I talk about all of this on my social media, whether it's fatherhood or faith or aesthetics or anything else. And so you can follow me. It's at Tanner Guzzi on both Twitter and Instagram. And then if you're not afraid of the very unique Latter-day Saint bent to it, I also run a podcast that's that dives a lot into spirituality and and relationships with God. It's called Spiritual Arson.
It's such a great name, by the way. Every time I see it, I'm like, God, that's so good. That's good.
It's a fun one. Yeah.
Yeah. That's so good. I, your Instagram, I'm going to like specifically plug your Instagram because that's been, something for me that's been super helpful. Or just you post these videos of just you chatting, having a take on something, and it's always so good. It's always so good.
Thanks.
So Tanner, thank you again, man. It was such a good time. And I hope we can get together again sometime, even if not for this, just to chat, man.
Absolutely, man. No, I would love it. Thanks for having me on, Remy.
Love you, brother. Okay. So I said up front that I was giving away a copy of Tanner's book, The Appearance of Power, How Masculinity is Expressed Through Aesthetics. If you would like to win this book, all you have to do is share this episode of the podcast and tag me in it on Twitter, either at Lutheran Answers or at Blood Conquered, or on Facebook, tag Lutheran Answers, share this episode. At the end of the week on Friday, I will be going through all of the tags that I have, picking someone at random, and sending them a copy of the book. If you don't want to wait, or if you want to make sure you get a copy of the book, just order it on Amazon.com. I'll leave the link down in the episode details. Thank you so much.